Warning, this episode contains graphic descriptions of violence. Listener discretion is advised.
The first degree.
You see it on the news, you see it on the paper, you see it on Facebook.
These things are supposed to happen in movies, not in real life.
And so for months, I used to think, well, I bet that, you know, whoever dumped her body was probably in those woods and saw us and is now going to come find us. So in my mind, that meant that we had done something that would upset the killer.
Hey guys, welcome to The First Degree, the true crime podcast that you might end up on. My name is Jack Vanek. I'm sitting across from Alexis Linkletter and next to Billy Jensen. And Billy, I did want to bring up the fact that I started reading your book.
You did?
And I feel proud.
How far did you get?
I'm on the Bear Brooks murder chapter.
Oh, really?
The bodies in barrels chapter, yeah. Or whatever it's called.
So you know about my childhood right now.
I do. And I was telling Alexis earlier that you are such a beautiful writer, and especially when you talk about your dad, it's so sweet, and I think you did like such a wonderful job.
Thank you so much.
And I really enjoy it.
That means a lot. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's I wish great. I could meet your dad.
I know. He seems like a great guy.
But he is awesome. Yeah.
I'm really excited to read the rest of it. I am doing it for, we have a book club podcast on the Lady Gang Network called The Stacks. Mm-hmm. And I recommended that we read the book for that.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So if anybody else is reading Billy's book and wants to have a little chat about it, I'll be talking about it on The Stacks coming up. So it's kind of exciting.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Oh, Billy is emotional.
I am a little emotional right now.
It took a lot. Well, we're all so freaking busy. I haven't read a book in years. So it was about time. And you know what? I'm going to start reading audiobooks or listening to audiobooks, because it's basically like listening to a podcast, but then you feel smarter because you said you've read a book. Mm-hmm.
You can say you read a book with that. Absolutely.
Oh my gosh.
Right? It's a life hack. Seem smarter.
See, honestly, though, if I was listening to Billy on the audiobook, I would be so distracted.
Well, it is kind of funny.
Because
I feel like I should talk back to him. Like,
yeah. I'd be like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
You know?
I'd be like, Billy, you sound like a fucking idiot.
Yeah.
You'd be like, but really?
Yeah, exactly. But if it was someone else, I'd be like, wow, Billy's brain is fascinating. But because it's his voice,
it is a very...
It's troubling.
It is a very interesting thing.
Just listen to it at 1.5 speed, then it'll sound like...
Oh, yeah. Do you talk too slow?
No, but it won't sound like me. It'll sound like somebody that is me, but...
On cocaine.
On cocaine.
I love it. So, I didn't talk about it last episode, but we are still doing our competition to win some free First Degree merch by giving us a 5-star review on the Apple Podcast app. So, when you do it, leave your Instagram. We'll be picking 2 a week, and you can pick out whatever you want from the merch store.
That's right. Whatever you want. Not just like, oh, we've got these 3 things.
Get a sweatshirt. They're the most expensive.
That's true.
So, what's today, Billy?
It's National Comic Book Day.
I knew you were going to pick that one.
You knew I would pick that one.
Duh.
Let me ask you, ladies, what was your favorite comic book growing up?
Never read a comic book in my life.
Ever?
No. What would I read?
Wonder Woman was mine.
Did you actually read it? Or are you saying that because it's the only one about a woman?
It's the only one about a woman or Catwoman.
I know you so well.
Yeah. Well, I was making a facial expression where it was obvious. Do I look like I'd read a comic book?
All right. I'm gonna get you guys some comic books. It's also...
No, thank you. I'm decluttering.
It's also National Lobster Day.
That interests me. That interests me.
Because you guys
delicious
like butter.
Lobster is my favorite food.
Lobster is one of my
Surf
favorite
Surf and
foods.
Turf or a seafood tower. My favorite foods.
Oh, I just love like a good lobster.
Or lobster roll.
A lobster roll's amazing. Mm. A lobster sushi situation.
Lobster hand roll from... Yeah. Sugarfish is good.
Okay. But it's also National One Hit Wonder Day.
Ooh. You want to know my one hit wonder story?
Yes.
MC Hammer can't touch this?
No.
He's not a one hit wonder.
How many did he have? Name another one.
Well, he's also broke.
Name another one. He can't. One hit wonder.
No, the Addams Family song.
That's not his.
Yeah, it is. Family.
Do what you do when you want to do it. Yeah, the Addams Family. Yeah, he did the Addams Family.
What the fuck are you talking
about? MC Hammer wrote the Addams Family song?
Not the original Addams Family song, but the one for the movie.
Then no.
Yeah.
No.
That doesn't count.
Okay, can I tell you my one-hit wonder story?
Yes.
Yeah.
I used to hook up with one of two twins that used to be in a one-hit wonder. God damn
it. It sucks when you work with one of your besties.
It was, he was in a 90s old.
He had a bad rock. Back.
He had sciatica.
She's like, I think he's too old for me. He can't sit up straight. I'm like, what?
Well, I went over at his house one day.
Was it Right Said Fred?
What?
I'm Too Sexy? Was it that band?
No.
Okay.
It was Evan and Jaren.
What was that song?
You're just the girl I'm looking for. I don't know. It was a 90s like alternative like pop song.
No, they're not.
But it was a one-hit wonder. That was their most popular song. So
yeah.
At least they had one.
I heard that Delilah Plain White Tee song.
Hey there, Delilah. I love that. They used to come to our house and hang out at Pink House.
Damar.
And so did the guy from
a lot of guys.
Take a look at my girlfriend.
Oh,
he's the only one I got.
Da-na-na-na. Travi.
Gym Class Heroes.
Yes.
He used to come over too.
Yeah.
Okay, but that was not. That Take a Look at My Girlfriend thing, that's from Supertramp.
Yeah, that they sampled it for. Yeah,
that's it's good.
Yeah, they were great.
Anyways.
All right, well, that's enough of that. So let's turn down the lights.
And turn up your anxiety.
Because this could be you.
Today's case takes us to Birmingham, Alabama, the heart of the Deep South. Birmingham's official website describes the city as nestled at the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains at the cross-section of two major railroads. The city was once the primary industrial center of the southern United States. And at the height of the nation's manufacturing age, the city grew so fast in population, it was, maybe ironically, maybe not so ironically called based on today's case, the Magic City.
The Cahaba River is the longest free-flowing river in Alabama, one of the most biologically diverse in the U.S. and considered by many to be the most scenic rivers in the country. At the time, this area was serene, remote, quiet, and isolated. In July of 1986, a 14-year-old named Elizabeth was running for track practice, and she and two of her teammates were running down a remote road that intercepted the river.
In July of 1986, me and two friends of mine from Briarwood were running summer track with Mountain Brook. Mountain Brook is the public school, and we were running track with them for the summer to get ready for cross country, ninth grade cross country in the fall. And it was a run anywhere you want day, a free run day. So we were running through the neighborhoods of Mountain Brook. Mountain Brook's a very affluent suburb of Birmingham. Nothing really bad, quote unquote, ever happens there, at least that you would see. So we were just running with abandon, you know, not scared, just having a good time. We were singing the Moody Blues song, Once Upon a Time in Your Wildest Dreams, at the top of our lungs. As we got to the very end of the big hill that goes up to the high school, we came across a bridge.
As the teenage girls ran across the bridge, something compelled Elizabeth to stop and look over the railing at the riverbank below.
At that time, it was a totally remote area. The bridge had woods surrounding it. So we decided to walk across the bridge. And on both sides of the bridge is a little walkway. So we stepped over on the side of the walkway and just randomly looked over the bridge.
And what she saw was beyond her comprehension. And it would change her life forever.
And down at the bottom of the rocks, it was just a rocky bed. There was not any water. There was a woman laying there, and she was spread eagle. Her legs were apart. She had blood on her, and she had blonde hair, and it was kind of back. And I remember just looking at her and thinking, wow, why is there a mannequin lying there on those rocks with ketchup on it? It just doesn't make any sense to me. And my mind just kept trying to make sense of what was going on, because that's what your mind does in a traumatic situation. And so that's what I kept coming up with. It must be a prank, a football prank or something. They've thrown a mannequin with blood. I was frozen in that spot. I couldn't move. My friends at some point did start moving. Then they came back and got me.
They ran for help.
So we ran up the hill that goes towards the high school. We knocked on the first house. No one answered. The second house we were knocking on, and actually the lady drove up at the same time that we were knocking. And for some reason, she did not believe us. And she said, well, she was going to have to go check it out herself. That was probably a mistake she wished she had not made.
The police swarmed the area within minutes, and news trucks weren't far behind them. And responding officers ran through the potential scenarios from the bridge when they were looking down, observing this body beneath the bridge. Could this be a suicide? Could this have been an accident? But once police got closer to the victim, it was clear that this was no suicide, this was no accident. She had multiple sharp force injuries, and her body had been terribly, terribly mutilated. She was nude except for some tattered knee-high pantyhose. And they could tell that she had been there for less than 24 hours based on the condition of the body. And one other thing they could glean with their naked eye was the fact that she ran for her life before she was murdered. The pantyhose that she had on were shredded on the bottom of her feet.
The crime scene was like not, it's not like it is now where things are like taped off immediately. It was kind of a lax crime scene at the very beginning, because we're just sitting in the middle of it. And at one point, I'm the one that was sitting on the curb and looked down and said, hey, there's a trail of blood right here.
Elizabeth pointed out to the police that there were smears of blood on the bridge. They instantly theorized that she had been thrown over by whomever had killed her.
As the news trucks continued to arrive on the scene, murmurs of the victim's identity could be heard. When one of the reporters arrived, she was absolutely horrified to realize that she recognized this victim. She was a beautiful, blonde, 26-year-old named Tracy Schotlin. Tracy had actually interned at the reporting news station years before when she was in college.
And Tracy's family didn't know about the murder yet, but they knew something was wrong because Tracy hadn't come home from work the night before and they were worried sick as to why, and they were trying to track her down. Tracy was always on time. She was extremely responsible and she would never just leave or disappear without any sort of explanation. And there's no doubt that Tracy's family was devastated upon receiving the horrific news.
The police learned that Tracy was extremely ambitious, was about to enter into law school, and dreamed of becoming a lawyer. She was so determined that she'd taken the LSAT multiple times so she could get in. She was a type A person who strived for perfection. Her long-term goals included graduating from law school and working with people who were underprivileged. She had been saving up for things she needed for law school by waitressing at the South Point American Cafe, and that's where she had vanished from the night before.
Tracy's body was taken in for autopsy, and it was conducted the day after her body was found on July 15th. The coroner found no presence of alcohol or drugs, and he identified 3 stab wounds to the upper lobe of the left lung, 1 stab wound through the heart, 5 stab wounds through the liver, and 2 stab wounds into the stomach area. The stab wound to the heart area was found to be 3.5 inches deep and would have caused death in less than 1 minute.
There was a defense-type wound to her middle finger where a tendon was cut. And there were several antemortem head injuries, including bruised lips and eyelids, a chin abrasion, fingernail marks, and an indication of running injuries. Remember, we had talked about that with her pantyhose. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There were 3 stab wounds to the neck that were found to be consistent with wounds inflicted by a dull pocket knife or a letter opener. There was antemortem bruising to the left nipple consistent with pinching, as well as antemortem impact abrasions. We're talking about a total of 19 stab wounds, 14 of which were located between the left breast and the left abdomen. So that would indicate potentially, just looking at this,
overkill,
but also a righty. There was a bruise to the right thigh and a rip which extended upward from the rectum and vagina into the pelvic area. And this latter injury consisted of a vaginal tear and massive blunt force trauma to the area. And both of these were also antemortem injuries.
And antemortem means you're still alive when it happens.
They concluded that Tracy had been dead at least 8 hours prior to the discovery of her body. And the day after Tracy's autopsy, she was buried at Elmwood Cemetery in Birmingham. There were hundreds of people who attended the funeral, and a lot of them were strangers who simply wanted to comfort Tracy's family after hearing the horrific details of her murder.
There was an outpouring of support from the community, but with that comes an incredible amount, an outpouring of media coverage. Because things like this just didn't happen in Birmingham, Alabama. This was not just another typical homicide. Panic started to sweep through the streets when people learned of the manner in which Tracy was killed. It's something that was like a punch in the gut to everyone in the community. Who would do this and why? I mean, we're dealing with an incredible amount of fear because it wasn't just she was stabbed until she was dead. There was a ton of mutilation. It seemed driven by something sadistic and scary. And, you know, this is the wholesome Bible Belt community. They just did not know what to think about this. And Elizabeth was experiencing the effects of what she had seen and witnessed.
So after finding Tracy's body, I started to have nightmares where we, you know, my mother at the time decided it would be a good time to have me read the Ted Bundy book. My mom, a little bit, sometimes we could say, is maybe not of the soundest mind, thought that would be like a good way to, you know, really help me understand what was going on out in the world. And so I immediately, though, started, you know, just would have flashbacks of the image of the body. And it would come over and over and over. And it was not pleasant at all. I didn't really understand what was going on. Then I would, like I said, wake up screaming. I was terrified.
So the police start their investigation, and they're trying to first piece together Tracy's movements from the night she went missing. She had told her coworkers that she was exhausted and she was going right home. She left. She walked towards the post office, which is a block away where she had parked her 1973 black Chevy Monte Carlo. So they figured out that Tracy probably made it to her car. So she must have encountered something between where she was parked and her house. And they went through her inner circle, the men she dated, friends, family. They got nothing. All they learned was that Tracy was beloved. She had no enemies. She wasn't involved in anything nefarious. Every road that they went down was a dead end. And her murder was really starting to look like some type of random encounter.
So the scene where Tracy was found was processed for evidence, and they concluded that this place at the bottom of the bridge was not where she had been killed. So this was not a crime scene. Instead, it was a dump site. It was also 1986, which meant that DNA was in its infancy. There was not much that they could find that was really that helpful. And no DNA evidence was found. Her clothes were gone. There were no footprints. There was blood on the bridge that suggested that her body had been thrown to the bottom, but that's it. However, there was one speck of evidence that was found on Tracy's body, and that was a single piece of reddish glitter that was found on her knee. And glitter is pretty obscure. They had no idea what to do with this or how to really use it to find the person who had killed her.
I think what also made it even more horrific is as details started to come out, you know, her vagina had been gutted. She had been stabbed either 17 or 19 times. Her breast had been sort of like bitten a little bit, and you could see that from the bridge. And then there was the glitter they found on her. So then it became in the community a hysteria of, is this a witchcraft thing? Because in the 80s growing up, everything was all about Dungeons and Dragons and serial killing, and or you know, do we have a Dungeons and Dragons witch murder going on?
But there would be one more significant piece of evidence that would come up. A woman named Lily Daniels, she had read about the victim's murder and was walking to a store on the city's north side when she found the victim's partially burned driver's license on the ground. And she immediately called the police, and the police came and got it. And the cops spoke to her parents and learned that Tracy always kept her license on her in her pocket instead of in her purse. Police decided to hold back this info, so they didn't release this to the media.
So the public caught wind of some of the details of this investigation, probably because some of it was leaked on purpose so they could try to find a suspect, and probably because, I mean, the rumor mill was churning. So the notion that this could have been a random encounter horrified them, and they had learned that nobody in her immediate family or friends had been zeroed in on as a suspect. And everyone was worried that a serial killer could be on the loose. Could this type of murder happen again? And seriously, the entire town was on edge and believed that the next person was going to turn up dead any moment now.
It was the biggest murder that had ever happened in Birmingham. And when I say biggest, I mean the goriest, the most coverage. Tracy was very beautiful. She was white. She had blonde hair. And as we know, unfortunately, those tend to be the crimes that get most coverage in the media. But the fact that she was, that Tracy was dumped over a bridge in Mountain Brook was just very, very shocking for everyone. They had their guard up. People were hyper aware. And it was really, really terrifying because they did not find the killer.
Okay, so very interesting. I personally was very curious about what glitter could be used for in terms of witchcraft, because I see glitter as like a very commercially produced thing. When you think witchcraft, for me at least, I think like a bundle of sage or like frog's eye, or, you know, it was like the things that they used in Hocus Pocus where they throw random organic stuff in. But apparently glitter
is just not something that you would, it doesn't have a connotation of
not
witchcraft.
With like pagan or witchcrafty things.
Glitter is what you associate with a strip club,
basic bitch.
No, or crafting,
or which I am a fan of.
Yeah,
but anyway, so I googled what glitter could be used for in sort of witchcraft. Mm-hmm. So according to a post in the Witch Circle, ooh, which is a message board, it says, also, glitter acts as a booster of sorts to amplify intent and to explore effectiveness. Typically, the addition of glitter, and when they say effectiveness, they mean of a spell.
Right.
Typically, the addition of glitter is best utilized in money spells, as it is symbolically more festive and celebratory. However, for spells requiring more of an instant razzle-dazzle, which is one of my favorite terms,
yes,
attracting new love, nailing a job, interview, it doesn't shy away from serving its purpose. Plus, as it burns, it can be used as a form of divination, much like tassiography.
Tassiography is a method for fortune-telling that uses tea leaves. Or coffee grounds or wine sediments.
Oh, so are they thinking like you throw some glitter in? Because it's all about where the water throws these pigments, mm-hmm, sediments.
Yeah.
Particles.
Yeah, I think that's what they're going for. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, you ladies who have your glitter left over from your glory days, you know what to do with it now.
Start a spell.
Exactly. Jacqueline, did you have a question?
Oh, my question was just that glitter, I believe, is plastic, and burning plastic creates toxic fumes.
I think, is glitter like metal? And I think is a little metal, or is it just plastic?
I thought it was magic.
Oh, I thought it was fairy tales and moonbeams.
Yes, mm-hmm, yes, rainbows and sunshine.
But so what's going on here is that we're in the mid 80s, and people heard glitter and people heard witchcraft, and they went right to the devil worship and Satan. what was going on now. We had the McMartin case, which was a big case
in California,
of this daycare that was being accused of molesting children via witchcraft. You had a little bit later on, you had the Ricky Casso case
in New York
on Long Island. You had all of these cases where, and there was so much of what they called satanic panic.
Yeah.
And we're also, for here, we're in the Bible Belt. So this is going to be really scary for everyone.
Well, and these are the people who are hyperreactive to it.
Yeah.
Where it's like you see a heinous crime and then you hear the person is listening to music that has like the mention of Satan or this or that. They're going to immediately jump to like the devil, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like in coastal cities, we're less susceptible to that, even at this time.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly not, because the McMartin case happened
in Huntington,
in a beach city. But I feel like back then when this happened, given the like unnecessary mutilation of the body and just the shock value, you know?
No, listen,
since something like that crazy of a murder hadn't happened there in quite a while.
Ever.
Like that, it's not just like somebody turns up dead under a bridge. Like there's a lot more to that that is horrifying for everybody around.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's the, you know, we're talking about Birmingham, and Birmingham is one of the most racially divided cities ever, and also conservative. And there were a ton of of horrible crimes that had been committed there. But when they saw something like this, and God and the devil and everything is so much of a part of their life on Sunday, and then that branches out, that's where they're going to go. They're going to point to it, and they're going to say, you know what? This can't be something that happened with a quote-unquote regular person. You know, they would do really bad stuff to people of color, but for them, they'd be like, no, this can't happen here. This has to have been committed by somebody that was under control of
the
Satan.
Devil.
Yeah.
And it was such a big deal on the news all the time. You know, we hadn't found the killer. Most gruesome body in Birmingham history. When are we going to find the killer? When are we going to find the killer? And it became a thing really where the media was stoking the fear of the community. And so for months, I used to think, well, I bet that, you know, whoever dumped her body was probably in those woods and saw us and is now going to come find us, because they had said that the police had said, you know, if we hadn't found her so quickly, they wouldn't have been able to get an ID that quickly and be able to work on the case that quickly. And there was no, her body hadn't decomposed at all. So in my mind, that meant that we had done something that would upset the killer.
So as news of this case permeated, witnesses from the night Tracy went missing started to come forward. A man named James Dudley Parker came forward and told police that he had seen Tracy after she had left for work that night, and she was even still wearing her uniform. James knew Tracy because he'd worked with her at a restaurant a few years back, and on the night he'd seen her, they were at Tom and Jerry's convenience store at a gas station on the south side of Birmingham. He saw Tracy enter the store right before he did, and he stood in the cashier line behind her and watched her buy two quarts of motor oil. They acknowledged each other briefly, and then she walked out and was going towards a light blue car.
And when James Parker left the store himself, he looked toward the left and he saw a man in a 1969 to 1971 blue Datsun or a Toyota. And it seemed like the man was waiting on Tracy. And he took a good look at him because he assumed that this was probably Tracy's boyfriend.
Well, and Tracy was beautiful.
Right, yeah.
And so, she's like, he said more in depth in an interview. He's like, well, you know, I worked with her once. She was this pretty girl. And I wanted to, like, see what her husband or boyfriend, what the deal was.
It's the same thing as Googling.
Absolutely.
You know, who people's significant others are. So the following day, when James found out about Tracy being murdered, he calls the cops right away, as you should, as you always should, and he gives a description of the man he had seen that was that he thought was waiting on Tracy. He described the person as a white male, 30 to 32 years old, with dark hair worn in a ponytail. Now the police had something to go on, and they had a place to start looking for clues, which was Tom and Jerry's gas station.
Right. So the police go to Tom and Jerry's, and they speak to an employee there. And that employee tells them that, yes, he remembered a blonde female around 26 who was wearing a restaurant uniform coming in and asking for assistance and selecting 2 quarts of motor oil. They then found Tracy's disabled black Chevy Monte Carlo nearby on 18th Street on the south side of Birmingham. But before doing this even, I mean, the guy who worked at the gas station showed them. It was back in the day when you had a cash register that just spat out the long strip of sales. Mm-hmm. So we showed them, like, listen, like, it was like $1.69 for each quart. And they showed them, like, this was the sale. They had a timestamp. I mean, it corroborated exactly what this other witness had said, right, which made him very credible and made them believe the account of the person Tracy was with even more. After they found Tracy's car, a mechanic inspected the vehicle and found that it had a bad starter and that, you know, once it was cranked, fuel would run out of the fuel pump and the engine would stop running, and that they also found that the car was 2 quarts overfilled with motor oil. They asked Tracy's family about this, and the dad in this, it's heartbreaking because it reminds me of my dad, because every time I have a problem with my car, I call my dad. But the dad said, you know, the one thing I taught Tracy was how to fill her own oil. Mm-hmm. And it's the only thing she knew how to do. So if there was something wrong with her car, she thought she was out of oil or low on oil. And it just, you know, when something was wrong with her car, it had to be oil.
Yeah.
It had to be oil. And yeah, she went and she got oil and she tried to refill it herself. And it was like the car was 2 quarts over. Like, her car was fine, but she's like, oh, my dad taught me it's oil.
Yeah.
And she tried, and it just breaks my heart. So police, you know, were canvassing this entire area, and they then eventually found 2 empty quarts of oil. Well, you know, oil cans with price labels like those in a 55-gallon garbage can near where her car was found. So at this point, they're starting to piece together a theory. Tracy left work, but sometime on her drive home, her car broke down. There were no cell phones back then. So think about this. Your only choice as a woman, your car breaks down. Do I accept help from a stranger or do I walk somewhere?
Oh, God. That's
terrifying.
It's terrifying.
Those are your only choices. Yeah. Both would be considered now probably a high-risk choice.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you don't have another choice at that time. So those were her choices. And basically they believed a stranger picked her up, offered to help her, brought her to buy oil, and then went back to her car with the oil. When the car still didn't start, the stranger offered to drive her home. And sometime between then, because they know the oil went into her car because her car was 2 quarts overfilled.
Yeah.
So they know that she made it back to her car. But sometime between then and when she was supposed to be driven home, she disappeared. So they have a good theory, and they believe that that's when she was killed.
Over a handful of weeks, James Parker assisted in making a composite drawing of the man that he saw. He reviewed hundreds of photos of mugshot books and accompanied members of the sheriff's department on several occasions to Southside night spots in an attempt to spot the man that he had seen on the night of the murder. James Parker was even put under hypnosis to try and shake some loose memories or identifiers of the suspect from that night, but nothing ended up working.
And we've talked about this before in other episodes, but, you know, something that I despise was starting to come into this investigation. And it was...
I think it's important for this episode. It's another thing. It's 86 to put us in the correct time.
Understood.
This was commonplace. We saw this in Katie Beers.
Yeah.
No,
and this was like, this was big in Katie Beers. It was like helping to solve it. And this was later than this.
Yes. The only reason why I like it is in a sense, and what we're talking about, everybody, is we're talking about psychics. And I don't believe in it. But what it does for me the only reason why I think it's okay is because it gives the local press another thing to write about and keep it in the consciousness, keep it in the news cycle. Oh, a psychic came and whatever. And, you know, it's pretty much denounced right now, but you're right, Alexis, in the 80s, it was like, oh, a psychic came in. And they were using psychics back in Boston Strangler. They had a psychic.
90s, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, back in the 60s, they had
no,
they had
it, 60s, so. No doubt. 70s, yeah. No doubt. 80s, no doubt. 90s, they were still doing it. Yeah. 2000s, it had subsided.
Yeah.
However, it was one of the top shows. Like, Long Island Medium was still topping charts past 2010.
Well, people still believe it. I mean,
of course. But I'm saying, like, it's not, it's crazy when you think about it in terms of police work now. Yes. But it only became, like, quackery in the 90s, late 90s.
Yeah.
So they start calling, and especially given the circumstances of the case, because we've got the glitter, the devil worship, the severe mutilation of the body, and also the intense media coverage. So they're all coming out of the woodwork now.
Mm-hmm. Of course, because they probably feel compelled to based on their, like, clairvoyance,
and their visions,
goodness. So months passed, and any new leads were coming to a halt. So they had nothing to go off of in terms of who or why or what or anything else. They looked for prints. They looked for everything that they could given the limitations they had as far as their technology, and they had nothing. All they had was this little speck of glitter.
It had been months with no movement in the investigation when another bizarro psychic kind of thing came in. It was November 4th when an attorney named Bob Sanford called the detectives working on the case. He said that his client, named Tommy Bradley, claimed to be having, quote, visions from God related to Tracy's murder case, and he wanted to tell them all the information that he knew. So the next day, the police met with Bradley and his attorney, and the attorney said to the police that Bradley would happily share whatever he knew as far as his visions if the police would tell them why he was being followed. The police were super puzzled by him because he was not being followed, especially not by them, and the police at this point were thinking that he was probably suffering from a mental illness, possibly experiencing some kind of a paranoia. So they did a cursory interview, but nothing this guy was saying was really holding any weight, and he also didn't share any info that wasn't already publicly accessible by the news and the media.
Right, and you see this a lot. When you find, for example, if there's a child found, you've got like 200 people coming forward claiming to be their lost mother. I mean, for some reason, when these kind of cases that are highly controversial come into the spotlight, it resonates with...
Yeah. And especially back then, too. Remember, we're talking about the 80s, before the internet, before everything. You see it a little bit, you see it less now. Back then, though, when things weren't Googleable or whatever, you would have people that would try to inject themselves into the story.
Mm-hmm. His face. He was sitting in his car in the driver's seat, and he looked at her. She wanted him to take her somewhere to buy something for her.
So what you just heard were some very, very old and poor quality audio clips from the interview with Tommy Bradley. And as you can hear, he says some very creepy stuff. He believes the killer was in a state of mind where he wanted a girlfriend. He talks about Tracy going to buy oil, about her going to Tom and Jerry's. But these were all things that had been reported on widely in the local newspapers. So is this creepy? Yes. Is it a smoking gun? Does it implicate Tommy in any real way? No.
You know, they had this interview with Tommy Bradley. Then they had another call, and Bradley, this was 2 days later, Bradley was making even more stranger claims. And the police thought it was odd, and they still didn't know what to make of it.
Right, because, I mean, they had been receiving all these calls from psychics. I mean, how do you know how to differentiate what to...
But you have to run everything down.
Of course, and they did. They did. And so in the months that followed these calls, the police were following leads, but they never took their eye off of Tommy Bradley because they had a weird feeling about him.
Mm-hmm.
And the detective kept a rapport with him and decided just to keep him talking because they had no idea what he would eventually say. And Tommy Bradley seemed like oddly invested in it, and they just got a weird feeling. It's the same thing you get when they anticipate criminals coming back to the crime scene or coming to vigils. Like, this guy had, he was like a moth to a flame in terms of this case. And this rapport kept going for months. And even though Tommy Bradley hadn't shared anything explicit as far as things that weren't available to the public, he had this gut feeling and he was just going to keep this going.
So with this revelation, the police are starting to think that this guy could be a viable suspect. So who is he exactly? Thomas Paul Bradley was a 26-year-old from the Center Point area of Alabama.
Which is a suburb of Birmingham.
Yes. He had gone to the local Bible college and he was extremely religious and belonged to a fundamentalist church. He wasn't married and he had recently been divorced and had no kids. But could Tom Bradley really be Tracy's killer?
And he was good looking. I mean, he was like this attractive sort of baby-faced, mustached, very ordinary looking guy. So they didn't know. I mean, he was kind of like a Bible thumper dude, and it was sort of anyone's guess. Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like, is he just this fundamentalist? Is he really seeing visions from God? Or like, is there something messed up about him that we're reading too much? Are we reading into this too much?
Mm-hmm.
So the detective, he's got the rapport with him, and he asks him sort of like nonchalantly, have you had any other visions about Tracy's murder? And Tommy's like, yeah. So they meet again 2 days later, and he said he actually believed that he could take the police to key locations from the murder. So over 2 days, he takes them around all these different locations in Birmingham, in the Birmingham area. And he actually points out the exact location where Tracy's car had been found, which was not released to the public. This is something that they hid to the public. And he also directed the officers to this bridge. And that was the same one that Tracy had been found beneath. And when they arrived there, he asked the cops, he was just like, stop the car. And then he proceeds to speak in tongues. And, you know, just sort of doing this sort of gibberish, unintelligible sounds for 30 to 40 minutes while he's gripping the dashboard and the door handle. They all get out of the car and he explains that the victim's body had been thrown from the opposite side of the bridge where it was actually found.
Right. So the police are just like, oh my God, because it's all adding up. I mean, this guy knows things that no one should know. And they're not sure if his dramatics are his attempts at like feigning psychic ability or feigning innocence. I mean, they're all trying to read his body language, but like in what he's doing, but no one's doing in that successfully because it's just very bizarre. But they had very, very many conversations with Tommy and they were all recorded. And on these audio tapes, Tommy Bradley describes visions he had actually as the killer. And in one recorded session, he said, and this is a direct quote, he's seen girls that he thought were attractive enough to go out with, even if he had to kill them before. And before we continue, I think we should bring it up. He's like an OG incel.
Yeah, he really is an OG incel.
He's an OG incel. And the more we learn about this, I mean, I don't think we should get into a conversation. I think we should do it at the end. But that hadn't occurred to me until just now. But let's get into it after.
Right. So he also gave graphic details about the murder and Tracy's final terrifying moments. He said, quote, she knew she was being killed when that, you know, when that knife started in her the third time and she uttered her last conscious, willful, volitional thoughts to God and towards herself and towards her friends and mother at that time. And that was that, I don't know what's happening to me, but I want y'all to find this guy.
So these interviews with Tommy Bradley continued. In one of them, he said something that essentially sealed his guilt in the eyes of law enforcement. What Tommy Bradley says there is there's something else about her license. In that the killer may have burnt it with a cigarette lighter. So Tommy said that in one of his visions, quote unquote, he could see that the killer burned something plastic, like the victim's driver's license, and threw it out on the road. And this is one of the only pieces of information, like Billy said earlier in the top of the episode, when Lillian came forward and talked about finding the driver's license, they did not release this to the public. This is not something anybody else could know. But what Tommy said was, you know, he saw in a vision that this driver's license had been burned, whether it's by a lighter or a flame, something to that effect. And that, you know, the fact that he's privy to this information that only the killer would know, it really nudged the police in the direction that this guy was involved. And he also knew that Tracy kept her driver's license in her pocket, in her jeans, rather than in her purse wallet. And that is something that just her family had told the police. He also knew that Tracy read The Power of Positive Thinking, the book. And that's something that the police also learned from her family. And it's something he recounted over and over again when he said to the police what he saw in his visions. And there's no way that Tommy Bradley could have known these things had he not been the killer himself.
And luckily for the police, Tommy kept doing something that you want your suspect to do. You want them to just keep talking, and he keeps talking. He talks about these visions of the murder for 20 hours. He describes in detail about how the killer came upon this woman, how he told her, you know what, I can help you out, just get alone with me, how he beat her, how he abused her sexually, and then how he killed her. He stated that the killer had come upon this disabled vehicle, that he came up to her and said, I'm going to help you, and fixed her car, and then expressed concern, though, that you're not going to make it home, so I'm going to take you, when you come to Tom and Jerry's, where we'll buy oil. And then he waited there for her in his car and then offered to take her home, and then she said yes.
He's basically giving the police like what they're already theorizing that happened. And he continued. He said that Tracy tried to run, and this is a direct quote, that when the killer, and when he says the killer, I mean, this is essentially a confession.
Yeah.
When the killer realized that the victim was performing sexual acts only to save her life, he began stabbing her. That she started fighting him. That as he was killing her, he shouted, "You ugly beast." That although she appeared to be dead after the third stab, he continued to stab her 8 to 14 more times to make sure that she was dead. That he then mutilated her internally, probably with an unusual knife with a big wooden handle or with a comb. That he performed witchcraft on her. That he took from her neck a gold chain with something hanging on it. And that when he realized that she was dead, he professed, "I'm sorry. I am sorry I killed you." He said Tracy knew, quote, she was going to be killed, that it was inevitable. And that the Tracy had authorized herself to be killed because she had willfully sinned. that the killer's motive was lust and revenge based on a girl in his past. Incel. I'm sorry. Based on a girl in his past. Get a grip, dude.
Yeah. And in these conversations, Tommy Bradley described the killer as someone, quote, like me, as having an above average IQ, being well-versed in the Bible, and strong-willed. He said the killer loved blondes and loved to inflict pain during sex. And he also made sure to highlight that the killer was very concerned about his mother not finding out about the crime. He said that the killer, quote, feels that his mother would be very disappointed in him, and that the killer had been molested by his mother when he was a very young child, and that the killer would come forward right now and be executed on public TV in front of the whole world if the killer could keep his mother from finding out he had done something like this again.
Wow. We have to stop because it's very reminiscent of our last two episodes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you see this a lot in these sort of these mother hangups.
Yeah. Well, listen, one of the most famous, you know, and it's fictional, but it does have a
Oedipus?
A ring of truth. Well, no, I wasn't going to go with Oedipus. I was going to go with Psycho.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know.
Of course.
And
it does have like a lot of truth in there.
It really does.
Yeah.
You know?
The relationship with his mom. We talked about this in the last episode, mm-hmm. though, that there are so many killers and serial killers that do kill, like, pretty strongly related to...
It's mommy slanted.
The mom, yeah.
What's interesting about it, you hear all the time with women, like, daddy issues. You don't hear mommy issues that much. Mm-mm. Because men either bury it,
yeah,
or they carry it out. It's true. It's either you don't even know they have mommy issues because they just... don't date a lot, or they're like sort of loners,
or just it,
or they, it's so obvious.
It manifests in like an extremely volatile way.
Exactly.
Obviously.
Yeah. So the police start digging into their suspect, and they learn that Tommy was a former high school chaplain. As a teenager, he was described as, quote, nice looking, clean cut, and religious.
He is good looking.
So they approached, he had actually had an ex-wife, and they approached the ex-wife to speak to her about Tommy. And what she said was that 2 years before the murder, when they were still married, she was inside Tommy's car and had seen a little bottle of red and pink glitter. When she asked him about this, what's this glitter about? He said that he used the glitter to perform witchcraft, which is the first time he'd ever mentioned anything about witchcraft throughout their entire marriage.
So with this revelation about the glitter, compounded with everything else that they had, the Birmingham Sheriff's Department finally felt like they had what they needed for the arrest they had been waiting to make. Tommy Paul Bradley was taken into custody at his family's home. He was charged with the capital offense of committing the murder of Tracy Shotland during a sexual assault. So once Tommy was in custody, it shone a big spotlight on him. The floodgates opened and people started coming forward, having their own experiences with him. And a woman named Jody Thompson came forward and detailed a chilling encounter she had with Tommy Bradley. In the early morning hours of June 25th, 1986, Tracy went missing on July 13th, just for some perspective. So this is like 2 weeks, 3 weeks before. While Jody was driving home on the Red Mountain Expressway from a Southside bar, Tommy in his automobile attempted to force her off the road by ramming her car. A high-speed chase down the U.S. highway ensued, in which Jody's car was bumped several times by this person, and she was eventually forced to stop. Jody rolled down her window at some point and exclaimed, "What on earth do you think you're trying to do?" And my theory is, that's like the PC version. She's probably like, "Fuck you, motherfucker, what are you doing?" Mm-hmm. He was trying to kill her. So I'm sure there were expletives involved. She could see that the man who was trying to ram her off the road had his penis out and was masturbating. So she immediately rolled up her window and locked her doors and sped away. Tommy again chased her down at high speeds, but when Jody brought her car to a screeching halt, Tommy zoomed away. Jody thought she was safe, She turned her car around and started driving back to Birmingham. But suddenly, Tommy showed back up again, ramming her once more. Eventually, she stopped at a traffic light, and he got out of his automobile. Luckily, her doors were locked, but he got out with his pants down, his penis fully exposed, and began banging his fists on the window of Jody's car and muttering something unintelligible, presumably speaking in tongues. Finally, Jody sped away, and she lost him. She reported the incident to the police, but can you imagine not having a cell phone and this happening to you?
That's so scary.
Especially in, like, the backwoods roads of Alabama. Listen, at least where I grew up, like Long Island, certain roads, someone comes by every 5 to 10 minutes.
Yeah.
These roads are even worse than what I'm used to, which is 5 minutes. Yeah. This is like every 20 minutes, maybe you got someone.
Maybe.
This guy is ramming her, stroking his penis. It's like she knows this is a sexual offender. Like, yeah. That, what I just read is my nightmare.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
And with no cell phone to call for help, you think you're about to die. Mm. It's just a nightmare.
So, not surprisingly, that's not the only incident of him being a fucking creep. Another local young woman named Kathy Ledbetter came forward. She had yet another ominous story about him at 5:30 a.m. on July 10th, 1986.
3 days before he murdered Tracy.
Yeah. Kathy was on the south side looking for a gas station, and she approached a car asking the driver if he knew where she could find one. He said that there was a gas station open a few blocks away. She said thanks and left, didn't think anything of it. And while Kathy was driving to find this place, she noticed the man was following her in his car. When she pulled into the gas station parking lot, he pulled up right beside her, and she could see through the window that he had his pants down and was masturbating. She called him a sick motherfucker and ran him to the building, and Tommy drove away, thank God.
And it didn't stop there. So the first one was in the last week of June. The next one was on July 10th. And then on July 12th, it was a woman named Karen McKinn. And she said that, and this is the night before Tracy's murder, she stopped at a Southside convenience store to use the phone. And she was attacked by Tommy. She said she walked past while she was on her phone. And then suddenly out of nowhere, he grabbed her face and slammed it against the window. And he then grabbed her chest and ordered her not to scream. And then, but Karen screamed anyway, which she should always do, and just started hitting her with the payphone receiver. And he had his pants down. He actually fled. And Karen reported this to the police. So what we've got here is he's ramping up.
He's escalating.
He's going from the last week in June to, you know, 3 days before the attack, a day before the attack. And he's trying.
And also, he's beaten in the face by a payphone with the last person he attempted to assault, which might just, like, amplify his frustration.
Well, and these girls, not that they keep getting away, but he's not having the conclusion that he wants. So he's probably getting more pissed off.
And, you know, he's probably strategizing, like, oh, I'm not nice enough. Fuck.
It's trial and error.
It really upsets me because it's all within 3 weeks.
Yeah. No, because he's thinking, like, because obviously Tracy would not have gone into his car if his pants were down.
Or if he tried to just, like, grab her head and bang it against a window.
So there was something between...
He's being finessed. He's finessing his approach.
There was something between those episodes where he's thinking, I can't do this. I can get this person in a vulnerable position if I don't have my pants down.
Right.
Which is insane.
It's disgusting.
So given what we learned about the women who come forward and given what we know about the evidence that we have, the arrest is obvious. The indictment is cemented. Now what the prosecutors needed was a conviction. And that would be a little bit harder to cement, as it always is, as even innocent people go free. But 59 witnesses total were called to testify, including his ex-wife, Ruth Miller, who we mentioned earlier, who talked about the glitter. And like we said, she mentioned the glitter. She mentioned that he was a devout Bible reader, that he was fascinated by blondes, and that he dabbled in witchcraft. And according to an article for the Alabama Journal, she said on the stand, he told me he liked blonde-haired, blue-eyed girls and that he just liked to have a lot of sex. But in addition to that, during the trial, jurors also heard these hours of confessions that were taped by the Birmingham Sheriff's Department. And they listened to everything he had ever said. So, not surprisingly, Elizabeth, who had discovered the body, who had discovered the blood on the bridge, was called to testify.
The DAs decided that one of the three of us had to testify. I'm also the one that found the blood. And I hate to admit this, there is such a sense of like teenage shame that goes along with this, but when like this huge case was going on and this huge, you know, all these articles and everybody's talking about it, there's, as teenagers, there's a tiny part of me that was like, man, this is a little bit cool. You know, I found this body and I'm going to testify and you know, and I hate to even admit it, but it was something that I kind of thought was cool. And the day of the day before, and it started to get a little more real. So I went to testify, and the advice I had been given was just don't look at him. Don't look at Tommy Bradley. So I was like, all right, I'm totally not going to look at him. Went out there, terrified. Any coolness that I thought about being able to testify was completely gone as soon as I sat down and raised my right hand. And I thought, what? Who? Why would you even think this was cool at all? This is horrible.
Elizabeth could see Tracy's family sitting in the front row of the court.
You know, I saw Tracy's family sitting there in the first row. They're crying. They're real. Everything became extremely real.
And she found herself staring into the eyes of the killer himself, Tommy Bradley.
And of course, immediately I look over to my right and there I see Tommy Bradley. And he's just a strange, strange looking fella. He kind of, I mean, he looks quote unquote normal, but he didn't at the same time. I mean, he had slicked back hair intentionally. He was young. He was 26 or 27. He had kind of a baby face. And I think that's one of the things that struck me, though, was his baby face, but with these eyes. And the eyes were just like hollow. It literally felt like they had nothing in them, no emotion, nothing. And I kept looking at him, and he would just keep staring at me in this way that to me just felt so creepy and so terrifying. And again, after I testified, I would think about it all the time, like, oh, great, he's not going to kill them for finding the body soon. He's going to kill me because now he knows my name and the name that's been in the papers. And now, you know, he's going to get out of jail and he's going to escape and he's going to come and he's going to murder me. And what was, I think, alarming to me is how I could not look at him. He would turn around and look at the audience, or the, I guess you call them the gallery, all the time, and kind of freak all of them out. And because that's just not normal behavior.
Tommy Bradley was convicted of capital murder, and he was facing execution by the electric chair. However, the jury and judge spared him the death penalty, and he was given life without parole.
And Tracy's family went up to Elizabeth's mother, actually, after the trial and had some kind words for them.
My mother said at the very end of the trial that the Shetland family came up to my mother and introduced themselves. And, of course, she knew who they were. And they just said, you know, we just wanted to thank you so much for you to extend your thanks, our thanks to your daughter for finding our daughter so quickly. We're so grateful that we could get her as quickly as we could and get her home with the Lord. And we're just so sorry that she had to see her in that condition. And we wish that she could have met her under different circumstances. And they talked about what a lovely woman their daughter was. And I just remember you know, even now it makes me feel a little bit tearful just thinking of this family that has lost their daughter, their pride and joy. She had entered law school. She was at the, you know, peak of her life. And they're such a kind family that what did they think about is me. I've thought about them many, many years since then. And I know that the brother is still alive. And so I'm thinking about writing him a letter and just telling him what his parents did, but also explaining how I have used, in some ways, his sister's death for positive and to help other victims of sexual assault and sexual violence in my career as a psychotherapist.
Yes. So after this experience and after experiencing this trauma at a young age, and she also experienced some other very traumatic events in college, Elizabeth actually decided to pursue a career in psychotherapy to help others. And not only did she help, you know, survivors of rape and sexual violence, like she just mentioned, but her own traumatic experiences allowed her a way to connect with veterans about some of what they are going and have gone through.
And then also, surprisingly, been able to help veterans where I work with soldiers who've come back from war through just the very, very small understanding I have of finding one body and knowing how much seeing one body messed with me and screwed me up, and thinking about my soldiers who found multiple bodies, some being their people they knew, some being their friends, some being, you know, mass graves, some being people that they've never seen in their lives. But it gave me just a teeny window of contact, but it did help out a lot in terms of being able to relate to the veterans as well.
It's really incredible that Elizabeth managed to turn a horrible traumatic situation that she experienced when she was 14 into something meaningful. We've both read the book by Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, and the theme of that book is you find meaning in your suffering, great or small. It is the way to take the power back. And Elizabeth, you managed to do that as well as help keep Tracy's memory alive. So thank you.
So what did we learn today? You know, he definitely has, when you're looking at him, could he have been a serial killer? That's the question.
Probably.
Fuck yeah.
He was definitely, he was leading up to it.
He confessed to it when he was talking about how the killer, he didn't want his mom to see him do this again. Like, that's...
Well, right.
And the way that...
He had attacked women.
Yes.
And he didn't follow through, but he...
Yes, he was ramping all of this up. And...
Masturbating while women were driving next to him. Yeah. It's just like this...
He's sick.
This impulse. It's like a organized lust thing that he's just not smart enough to control it.
But it's weird, though, that he does control it with his last victim. And he does say that, like, I can't do that stuff. I've got to keep it in control. Because
what are you talking about?
Because he doesn't have his pants off, because he had his pants off with everyone.
To lure her in.
Yeah.
Oh, well, no, he wised up.
Yeah, that's what I mean, though. Right. So he had...
I can't have my dick out. I just have to kill her.
He had the wherewithal to do that.
To control his impulses enough to actually get her in the car.
Which shows that you know...
And he's adapting.
And we often talk about...
Well, how many times are you going to try to approach a woman masturbating and thinking they're going to get in the car with you?
Literally every time, punch you in the face and call the cops.
No woman in this fucking world would be like, this looks like a great car to get into while this guy is fucking jacking
off. That's what I always say. When I'm walking down the street and a truck drives by me and whistles and honks, I'm like, has that ever worked for you? Learn. Ignore me and I'll get in your truck. Motherfucker.
Go make out with another girl in front of me and I'll want to make out with you. Listen, I passed a guy recently that was masturbating next to me. It's way more common than you would think.
That's the thing. It's like, that is such scary behavior. It's not like, oh, this guy's just a creep. It's like, no. That is so abnormal.
They cannot control themselves sexually, and that's fucking dangerous.
It's always going to escalate. Control.
It's control for sure. All right. Well, a big, big thank you to Elizabeth for being our first reconnection, sharing your story.
And trusting us with your story.
Yeah.
Thank you. And thank you for the work you're doing with our veterans.
Yes. Yeah. We appreciate it very much.
So much.
if anybody listening is 1 degree away from a murder or other Stranger Than Fiction story, please write us. Hello@thefirstdegreepodcast.com. You can write us on Instagram @thefirstdegree, @AlexisLinkletter, @BillyJensen, @JackVanek. Go buy some First Degree merch on our website. We got lots of fun stuff up there. And again, give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and enter to win some merch. All right, so welcome back to our second installment of Killing Time. And you're not even going to try to say The Killing Time.
The Killing Time.
Killing Time.
The Killing Time.
Okay. Well, I made a post on our secret Facebook group. If you guys are not a member of it, please join, asking what you guys want to hear us talking about. And I think for our second episode of Killing Time, everybody wants to know how we know each other and like how we became
this. That's a fair question.
Yeah. Alexis, would you like to explain how you and I met?
Yeah. Our mutual best friend, Anna, I met in the line of Big Wang's when I was 20 years old.
Which was a shitty
bar on Cahuenga.
Where I used to go all the time with my fake ID. It was one of the only bars that would take my fake ID.
The bouncer, Steve, would just let people in with their fake IDs.
All the time.
And then I had my 21st birthday there, and he was like, what? You're not 21? And I'm like, what? You didn't know?
I had the same thing there.
Yeah.
I'd been going for 3 years and then finally I turned 21 and I was like, hey, Steve.
I'm 21. And he's like, wait, what?
He's like, I thought you were Courtney.
So I met Anna in the bathroom and then we all just started hanging out. And then Jack and I moved in together in this crazy house at the base of the Hollywood Hills in Franklin Village.
We called it the Pink House.
The Pink House. And we had just the craziest year of our lives.
it was glory days. It was like a frat house. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like a sorority house. It was like a frat house. It was disgusting. It was dirty.
Well, we were just having a good time. We had parties every day.
Parties.
The upstairs wasn't dirty.
It wasn't clean.
It wasn't dirty.
It wasn't clean. When I moved out, we had a rat that lived in our house and I had gone on the Warped Tour like over the summer. And when I came home, there was rat shit all over my room.
Ew.
And then I never went in there. I like left all my stuff in there. I was like, this is it. All right. I guess I don't own any of this anymore.
Oh my God. It was fun.
It was fun. And then Alexis, how do you know Billy?
So Billy and I met. Actually, the first time I ever saw Billy was at the Smokehouse.
That's right.
What's the Smokehouse?
The very famous Smokehouse, which is it's a restaurant / bar, very old school, outside of the Warner Brothers lot.
Oh,
it's where like deals are made and everything. Ooh. And I think actually we were just talking about names of production companies and things that we've got.
Yeah,
I think George Clooney's production company is called Smokehouse because of the Smokehouse. Yeah.
Oh. Well, yeah. It's actually an interesting story. So I was working on a show for the Golden State Killer prior to the arrest.
Yeah.
And it was at the same time that Michelle was, I think, still working on her book when we were still in way pre-production. Mm-hmm. And where I was working, somebody, maybe a colleague of mine named Todd, was like, you know, this Billy Jensen guy. I'm like, what about him? Ew. And they were like, well, maybe, maybe we should meet with him. I'm like, I don't know. Okay. And I followed Billy on Twitter and I had like 5 followers. Like, yeah. I didn't really have a Twitter.
Yeah.
And Billy like wanted nothing to do with me. Isn't that right?
Yeah. Really? Like, went before you met her or after you met her as well?
Before.
He's still trying to get away from us. We kind of just have him like in captivity.
Before he saw me and he was like, nope. I want nothing to do with this. Did you tell them?
No, it's pretty much true. Yeah.
Did you take Alexis seriously when you first met her? Because
when I first met her, yeah.
You did?
So I met her we met at the Smokehouse with Alexis and Joke and Todd, but it was clear that Alexis knew more about the case than Joke and Todd.
Well, no, Todd knew the most.
All right.
Well, I was new.
What about Golden State Killer?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Todd told Michelle about it.
Yeah.
Like so, 10 years before.
So I was,
amenable.
So we met there and it was fine. It was lovely, but, Then what happened?
Billy thought that I was sent in as a pawn to try to coax information from him.
You would.
He did. He's like, this is like a young, attractive girl. She's trying to steal my... That's what he thought.
No way.
And then we became friends.
I do remember, I don't know if this is before you met Billy, but you're showing me his website and you're like, I want to copy his
website. I told you this, right?
Because your website's really cool. You have a very... The layout is...
The aesthetic. Very, thank you. It's the verbiage is pleasing.
It's cool.
The verbiage.
The verbiage.
And aesthetic,
yes. I remember it distinctly, and I've never seen it since, because I don't have a reason to go on your website. But
of course. No.
No, it was like the many... And it was about... Like, the about is like the many talents of Billy Jensen, or like the many...
It's very like... A series of unfortunate events.
Yeah,
sort of, yeah. Like, it's I don't know what it says.
I love it. Yeah. But then Billy and I became friends. Should we tell them where we went?
When?
After we became friends.
Yes.
We went to Jumbo's clown room.
Oh yeah. Okay.
So we were like, we're gonna be friends now. Let's go to Jumbo's clown room. And we're by gonna the talk, way, we're gonna talk true crime.
Yes, and for anybody that doesn't know what Jumbo's clown room is,
explain it.
Jumbo's clown room is probably one of the best, most famous. I don't even want to call it a strip club.
It's like a burlesque club.
It's like a burlesque club.
Yeah, because aren't they? They're
clothed. And tops.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. I'm so drunk every time
They have to cover up everything.
Courtney Love danced there. David Lynch used to write scripts from the bar there.
That's so cool.
It's like
it's iconic.
It's a very
Courtney
cool place.
Love
it's iconic.
There?
Yeah, yeah.
When?
Weird.
Yeah.
Like in the '90s?
I don't know. No, before that, probably the late '80s.
Oh, I didn't know it's been around for so long.
Well, they haven't redone anything inside.
It's a very interesting place. Like, highly recommend going to
if you ever come to LA.
Yeah, if you ever come to LA. So you guys went to Jumbo's Clown Room. That was like the bonding experience.
Exactly.
And then the podcast came up. You were telling me, you're like, I really want to start a true crime podcast. I wonder who I should do it with.
Well, obviously, I was like trying to get you to do it with me. And I had been friends. We'd never worked together. But Jack knows that I'm a neurotic, super hard worker, will never let anyone down. And I knew anything she touches will be successful.
Yes.
So it was like a recipe for success.
But you kind of, you're like, I don't know. Like, I kind of want to do this thing, but I don't know. And I was like, wait a second. I love true crime. Mm-hmm. I want to start a true crime podcast. Nobody will ever take me seriously doing it myself. So, well,
and then we put our heads together. We're like, what are we missing? We're missing. Listen, I have credibility because I produce shows, but Billy's got like the real credibility.
You've got street cred.
And true crime is mostly female fans, and we were not going to fly just us. Let's be real.
No, they needed a man to lust over.
Exactly.
Enter Billy Jensen.
They need a man to lust over and women to relate to.
Yes.
So it's like a winning combination to have all three. But we took Billy to drinks at the Roger Room.
Yes.
Yes.
And he was like, tell me what you got. And we were like, sup. And me and Jack were like brainstorming at Soho House all day, talking about it. We had finally... No.
We had
two meetings.
We were brainstorming. I think when we first started talking to you, we didn't have the idea for the first degree.
No, he's like, what's your idea?
No, I said, well, what's the hook?
Yeah.
There's a million true crime podcasts out there. What are we going to deliver that's different? Mm-hmm. I like both of you. I would love to hang out with you.
Me, the stranger.
But
he's like, Jack, I like your 300,000 followers.
Your 300,000 followers.
That's a recipe for success.
Retired emo kid
and
shirt.
And you like my work ethic?
And I like your work ethic. But what are we going to do?
I know how to produce a TV show, so I know how to produce a podcast.
What's going to be different than any other true crime podcast? And then you guys went back to the woodshed.
Well, for like months, Jack and I took a long time.
It was a year between when we first started like brainstorming to when we actually released the first episode of the podcast, because we were brainstorming. We're like, what's the hook? What's going to make us different? We're going back and forth. And one day when we're just hanging out, we were both talking. I was talking about Nanette. And I was like, oh, it's weird that I like a mother of one of my like girls on my cheerleading team like killed her husband. And then you were talking about your story. And we're like, it's pretty crazy that there's so many people that are one degree away from something.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't really talk about it.
No. And I think it really just shapes you in a lot of weird ways. And I mean, like the episode we did today, I mean, she discovered the body of somebody and it shaped the trajectory of her life.
Yeah.
You know, and because it didn't, it's not just like, oh, I saw a body, no big deal. She had trauma from it. And then she ended up working in mental health and working with people who see bodies and are traumatized by it. And I think the idea that these are inconsequential things, I think is crazy. Like these are our worst fears realized.
Right.
And I think we all feel really impacted by anything close to us.
Right.
You know, whether it's like gossip or, you know, something traumatic or something scandalous, like we all sort of like, even if your best friend gets cheated on, you feel that reverberates. Like it's when you're connected to stuff, it's almost like it's happening to you.
Yeah. If you're not a psychopath.
If you're not a psychopath. Yeah. If you have empathy. If you have empathy, you like bleed for people.
Right.
Yeah.
In a small minority, like, listen, we talk about psychopaths a lot. Statistically, there aren't that many. So 1%, I think we're speaking to the
supposed
majority
to be 1%,
here.
1%, yeah.
But is it more? Because how do they really know?
I don't know. Have you read the psychopath test?
Yeah, I haven't read it in a long time, but I have read it.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, yeah, they become CEOs or killers.
Yeah.
That's what happens.
Or you date them.
Or politicians.
I wish
it was. Sometimes I do wish I was a psychopath. I feel like life would be a lot easier. So much richer.
And you didn't need friends. Probably, you didn't need human connection.
I know they're not happy, but you'd be.
They don't need happiness.
Content-ish.
They don't need happy. They just live for pleasure.
Yeah.
They just do what's pleasurable. They don't need happiness.
Yeah.
Imagine that.
Not needing happiness? Ugh. That sounds nice.
Well, I mean, I clearly don't need it because I haven't had it my whole life.
Perfect.
Stay tuned. I'm working on that. In therapy, guys.
Yes. Stay tuned for Alexis's next therapy session. Okay. Well, I feel like that was a good amount of killing time.
We killed some time. We killed 11 minutes and 24 seconds.
I think we killed some time there.
Should that be our sign off? I think we should.
I think we killed enough time.
I think we killed. We'll figure it out. Somebody give us a recommendation.
Yeah.
Thanks for killing some time with us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Adios.
Ta-ta.
Killed some time, bitch.